Writer's Voice, Mondays at 10 p.m. here on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport.
Welcome to Homepage Radio. I'm Duo Dickinson. I helped create this with Benny Klein, the magic goddess of music you just heard for the last couple of hours. And I'm joined in studio by the greatest, single most self-effacing engineer in America, Rod Richardson.
Okay, present.
There you are.
Present.
Present and accounted for. I'm also joined here with a great good friend, a wonderful human being, but also a significant perpetrator of beauty, Louis Makel. Hi, Louis.
Good afternoon, Duo.
And the only reason why Louis is here, which is actually the only reason why I'm here, and the only reason actually, well, Rod's here anyway, so it doesn't, you didn't really, weren't really brought here by anything. You just are here. But this is Homepage today, dealing with something which I think is the single rarest and most pervasive reality in homes in America today. And the rarest really is the ability to get your mind and hands and craft and physical being around the creation of beauty in your own home, the actual building or crafting of making a place where you live, and everybody lives in some place. They live in either a house or an apartment or something, a condo, co-op, wherever you live, making it your place. And for the vast majority of people, you know, maybe if we have 300 million people, for 250 million people, the first thought that comes to mind, the first thing they do is they buy a poster, they paint a wall, they get a cool piece of furniture, maybe they take out a wall, maybe they put in a window, but they never think ever about how that window was built, how that poster was designed, how it was printed, what happened to it. And today, this show is going to be called When Decorating Isn't Enough, meaning simply that for some people, people that care about it, people that can see the difference, people that have looked and seen that you could do more than just buy things or apply things or make a surface onto an existing place that you live. For those people, the idea of making beauty out of the things we use every day, the things that are time-dependent, use-dependent, function-dependent, but are also mostly store-bought, those things, and because it's Homepage, mostly in homes, can be exquisitely reflective of your values, but also be intrinsically innovative and also part of enriching the culture that we have today. And really, joining me in studio is Louis Makel. And Louis is one of three people we'll talk today that are essentially born in the mid-century at Yale, where there was an enormous, I would say, crockpot of creativity and interest amongst many, many people in the architecture and fine arts school. And Louis will be dialoguing with Barry Spiegels, another architect. And we also have a very special insertion of Kent Bloomer, who is in the School of Architecture but is also a sculptor. And you could make a case that Kent himself was someone who promulgated the idea that beauty was not crime, as architect Loos said, but beauty is actually almost the highest and greatest part of what makes humans different from other things. So with that, Louis, I'd love to have you tell us a little short history about why you came to New Haven, what you did here, and then a little diversion about Prickly Mountain, because that is actually one of those spontaneous eruptions of creativity that I think most people don't know about.
Well, thank you. For me, the original spontaneous eruption was deciding to become an architect. Mm. I was entering my senior year at Yale. I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I realized I better figure that out because I didn't want to commute to New York in a suit. Mm. So, propelled by that, I took some drawing lessons in my last year and basically began putting together a portfolio. I remember saying to my girlfriend at the time, you know, I think I'll become an architect. And then, because I sort of needed an out, but I didn't want a really good out. I just wanted an out. I said, yeah, until I change my mind, I think that's what I'm going to do. And amazingly, I enjoy it as much now, if not more, than I ever have.
And I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your intuition to become an architect was greatly informed, encouraged, and directed by humans. I mean, human beings that you came in touch with.
Yes. It's, but the point of all of this is to find ways to remind ourselves that we are alive in the first place. And a lot of things, well, everything slowly becomes dead. And it's up to us, the living, to fight back. And in particular, if you make things out of 2x4s and sheetrock and glass and so on, it's important that whatever you make does reflect the fact that you are alive, which means you're not pulling something out of the can that you did last time.
Right.
You're not clipping it out of a magazine because you think, oh, well, I'll just do that. You're clipping it out of some part of your brain, which in the middle of the night or perhaps over breakfast, realized, hey, you know, it really would be nice to see where the sun rises, you know, on a December morning.
Well, this really reminds me of a long discussion I had with David Sellers up at Yestermorrow up at Prickly Mountain, Vermont, and he was talking about the prickly houses that were done, what, in the late 60s, early 70s by you guys?
Late 60s.
And they broke all the rules, too, because they basically said, normally there's an architect and a builder and an owner, and all three things became one person up there.
Yes. Well, it was a... Dave did a great thing in so far as giving... creating an atmosphere of permission to express yourself with the skill saw and a sheet of plywood, and it was great. There was no question about it, and there was a somewhat of a disdain for things which one might buy out of the catalog. The idea was you got raw material and then you made something out of that. And the more raw it was, in a lot of ways, the better.
And when you say you made that, you know, unlike a lot of what we're used to today, where you go to a store and you buy things and you tack them in place, you folks up there would get very, very raw materials and then rethink how you made it, make them in a way which was expressive, and then the final result sort of reflected your own spontaneity, but also the nature of the materials you were doing. And there were, of course, huge failures, but there were also really wonderful expressions up there. And you actually participated in making your own house up there.
Yeah. I remember one of the things was the windows. I couldn't figure out how to detail the windows until I knew what the DeWalt radial arm saw could cut. Because the windows were going to get made out of that saw and the wood that came from, I think, the Lacolade Lumber Company. I didn't have a long history of woodworking. It was pretty short. So before I could detail the darn thing, I had to figure out, well, what could I physically do and what couldn't I?
Did you have a helper?
I hired another kid, you know,
another
who
guy.
Was in the architecture school, and that was about it. And I can remember the terror when the concrete truck was coming up the hill, you know, half a mile away, and the forms which I'd made out of plywood, which was too thin, and baling wire, which was also too thin, and... I'd never poured concrete before.
Yikes.
I actually have to say it was partly, in some great measure my older brother, who loved to make stuff and had no fear of making something that he had never made before.
I love it.
And I in part, this is testimony to his fearlessness in the face of a project which was new, which allowed me to do that.
And that incredibly heroic act that resulted in a really cool place, I think you said it was the only house there that had a flat roof in the entire
yes.
part of Warren,
yep.
Vermont.
Yep.
So you actually had a flat roof. Tell the segue for most people today here in Central Connecticut would be that you are the perpetrator or the genius behind and also the co-conspirator of a place which I think is really famous nationally. I know I've used it as an architect for 30 years, is a place called Breakfast Woodworks. Tell us how Breakfast Woodworks came involved and what part you as a craftsman woodworker and you as a designer architect, tell us how that duality worked for you.
Well, when you're starting out as an architect, the game is how to stay employed for more than your first or second job. So for me, that was simple. I borrowed a table saw from, I think it was Walter Goodrich, another good friend.
Yes.
Then with that, I could make things, and so I would get to the end of the drawings for a job and then offer my services to the owner to actually make the cabinets.
Right.
Or the stair, or whatever. And that progressed, and one day I hired a guy who was extremely good. That was Ken Field. We've been together for 40 years now. I have to tell a wonderful story, which is a few months ago, I noticed outside of the office a yellow balloon floating up close to the window, obviously left over from some party or something.
Right.
And I was surprised because there were rose bushes in front of the window of the office there in Guildford. And it didn't pop. I went out and pulled it in, and there it said 40 years and still counting.
Wow.
And it was within a month of when Ken and I had been together for 40 years.
That was totally spontaneous.
Absolutely.
Isn't that whacked?
If anybody needs to see a photo of the balloon, I'll send it to them from my phone.
And I have to admit that I think it was, in fact, 8 years ago that I darkened your door in your house in Guildford, Connecticut, because you said maybe I'd have a job for you. I worked there for a day or two, and then you said, thanks a lot, dropped dead, and left. Then you called me back in about 6 months and said, hey, I got work for you.
Yeah.
And that was an incredible 9-year experience for a young guy, because I can say to the people out there that think about going to Home Depot or think about going to Lowe's or think about, you know, getting some wallpaper, going to a place where there's nothing except raw materials that end up getting combined and recombined and rethought and just touched, I can say that the empowerment you'll feel if you decide not to accept being the vendor's recipient and providing an adhesive or an attachment and taking something prefab and sticking it into a prefab place, the idea that you can actually impact things, seeing that at Breakfast Woodworks, first in your house and then in Brantford and now in Guildford, it changes the rules of design, and I think it makes things very uncomfortable for some people and makes things incredibly great for other people. And I tell us how you work today, because you're just involved in that from the ground up all the time.
Yeah. Well, basically, I think of architecture as I practice it as ping pong.
Mm.
Client calls, wants to work on a house or an addition or frequently apartment renovations in New York City. And it's a game of ping pong.
Mm.
I get what they would like to do, and I fire back as soon as I can what I think a logical solution would be, and then we're off to the races.
Yeah, and they would never contact you if they didn't know that you had this ingrained ability to reinvent. They just wouldn't, because you're not unique. I think there are a lot of people like you, but you're one of the absolute best at defining new objects to new circumstances with different people. You really are, Louis.
Well, thank you. That's kind of you. I will say that the sequence goes something like this. I'll crank out a basic design. I'll get some feedback. Hopefully it's somewhat positive. Sometimes you don't hear for a couple of days, and then you realize, whoops, I have to give them a call. But in any case, then not too far after that, I realized, oh, no, gosh, no, that's not how this should go. This is, and I realized I am totally lost. And that's exactly when it gets interesting.
Right.
Because out of that lost comes then the solution, which is applicable to the actual situation as against this idea about what you thought
preconception the
situation was. And half the job of being an architect or any creative person is coping with the feeling of lostness without having despair.
Well, that's a great segue to the next part that we're going to be dealing with here, where I had the really a privilege to go talk to Kent Bloomer, who is on the faculty at Yale and is a sculptor, but is also a sculptor that does architecture.
And he's a star also,
he is, I might say. I would almost say that no person has ever taken a field of endeavor, and you'll hear in this interview he talks about ornament versus decoration, but no person has taken a reviled and degraded and often trivialized thing, such as ornament. It sounds like it's a birthday cake or maybe earrings. But he understands the fact that ornament was the essential reason why so many things were built since human beings became human, and has actually created an office in Erector Square in New Haven, where I was, which really has done work worldwide, and he's working now in Tokyo and Hong Kong, and he has done many things. If you take a look, actually, at Studio 360 in New Haven, all that botanic ornament that goes up the sides of the first floor parking garage on Chapel and State Streets, that's all Kent. So without further ado, Rod, I would love to sort of cue up and play for you the interview that I did last week with Kent Bloomer. So, Kent Bloomer, it is great to be in your studio with my intern, Keturah Barron, and we are here to talk to you. So, this is Homepage. It's a show that goes on every month, and we talk to people on the radio who all have homes, all have places to live. It's not necessarily freestanding homes, not even necessarily individuated homes. They have places to live, and they care about where they live. And your life, which started out, you told just me now, in... Was it physics? And then went to architecture and then went to sculpture. You took this amazing path that led you for the last, I think, 50 years?
Yeah. To focus on ornament.
And the word is ornament. Oh. And the word is ornament as almost a universal thing. Tell us how ornament has changed or created what you've done for 50 years. Tell us about that.
What I've done or
all of it. Just tell me what comes to your mind about ornament and you for 50 years.
Well, what I'm beginning to find out, first of all, having written papers and books on the subject, I discovered that one of the reasons why people couldn't understand what ornament is because they confused it with decoration.
Big deal.
Yeah. And the difference between... And so I did some research fairly recently. I've been giving a seminar on ornament for 40 years at Yale.
Yeah.
And the I was still having a series of problems. And I finally realized that unless I could divide the word ornament and decoration, the problems were going to continue. It's about 20 years ago I ran into this problem. So with a colleague, librarian with a doctorate in the theory of ornament from William George Ordy, we spent years doing an etymological search until we got to the root. It's a Latin word.
Decoration or ornament?
Both.
Wow.
And when we got to the bottom, We ran into what would have been a dictionary in the 7th century. It was the etymology. It was an etymology. And it described, the first thing it said was, the Greeks call ornament cosmos.
Really?
Yes. But it's a word, it's a substitute word for cosmos.
Cosmetician.
Yeah. Or cosmetic, or cosmopolitan even. But a chapter in the etymologies the Latin word for cosmos is mundus, which is world. The chapter was called Mundus et Partibus, which are the parts of the world. And then he listed Isidore, who was the head of this etymology in Plato's Academy. He listed the things that he called the parts, and they all came out to have to do with physical phenomena, nothing social.
So it was all just objects.
It was all a reference to the way things behaved in the cosmos. For example, it had to be something in motion.
Really?
It had to be something that had cycles.
Really?
There was no reference to human behavior. Los and some of the others got it all wrong. They confused it.
It's not crime. It's motion.
It has nothing to do with that. It's a representation of how the first thing they use is atom, and then they go to sunrise, sunset.
Yes.
The explosion
right.
of rainbows.
Yes.
And even rivers, serpentine rivers.
Always in motion.
Always in motion.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. So what Ornament talks about is basically physics.
Right.
It's visceral physics. The way it becomes, now decoration is rooted in decorum and decor, which has to do with good behavior,
right.
good manners, proper...
Towing the line.
Yeah. Propriety.
There you go. The law, we call it in Episcopal theology.
Yeah. Episcopal, the law.
The law.
The behavioral law. And the word that Vitruvius uses in the old book, on first remaining book on ornament, was that decoration is propriety, the law.
Wow.
So ornament has to obey propriety. If you put it in a church or in a home, you have to do it with decorum. But ornament is not the same thing.
See, that is one of the critical things. The reason why we do homepage radio is that I will bet you that every Lowe's and every Home Depot and every Walmart is filled with decoration and abilities to decorate.
No.
And almost no one has ever thought that that's really the tail at the very end of ornament. It's the least important thing, but it ends up being primary for them.
It's flipped.
And so for somebody's house, if you're talking to somebody that says, ornament in my house, tell me what you've done to make what you make in people's homes.
Well, I haven't done too much domestic work.
Right.
You've seen one of them. You've seen the staircase.
Yes, I have.
And basically, what happens to ornament, because of what it is, because it's supposed to represent the cosmos, it usually ends up in major public buildings.
Right.
Like churches and college campuses and town halls, et cetera, et cetera. So most of my work has been in libraries.
Yes.
In modern libraries, about 7 of them. It's hard for me to go down a list, but
what would somebody know? What would somebody know who is in the greater Bridgeport, New Haven area that you've done that they see every day? Because I see it every day. So tell us some of the stuff.
Well, for example, 360 State Street is an example. And 360 State Street is the last building on Chapel before you go across and get to the railroad tracks.
In New Haven, right.
Yeah, New Haven. So there's a big parking garage, and the parking garage was at the bottom of an apartment building. So it was a domestic. It was domestic.
Yeah.
Well, it was for people to live in as their homes, and to do that in New Haven, they had to build a parking garage on the bottom. So we transformed the parking garage into a 4-story ornamented structure that carried with it public, not parking
values. Yes, right.
Yep.
And I'm joined in studio today with Louis Makel, and who you know well, my former mentor. And I could make a case that with his extreme care to making beauty in the actual fabrication of things and what other people end up calling craft, there is that almost nascent idea that beauty can be found in motion, in tangible things, just like you do, but actually woven into the smaller scale.
Exactly. Oh, well, I mean, what I do about there, the period we're living in now is totally radical. It is unusual, and I don't buy the theory that there's been this big change due to technology, due to so-called progress. I think that's all rhetoric.
Interesting.
Yeah, and the it was propaganda mainly begun in Europe after the wars.
Right.
And it was put there to basically sell architecture by people who knew how to build buildings as against those who didn't. And, the sort of modern masters pummeled the idea of function, but that's a bag of bones. The person in the United States who put the word form follows function on the map was
yes.
Louis Sullivan, and he did it the first time it was uttered, except by a sculptor named Horatio Greenough, about 40 years before Sullivan did. He said form follows function when he was describing the Wainwright building that he had just designed.
In St. Louis.
And if you look at the Wainwright building, it has one of the most beautiful attics of ornament.
Oh, my God.
In the world.
I grew up in Buffalo, and so we saw the Guarantee building.
Or the Guarantee.
Yeah, isn't that amazing, too?
And so when he used the word, he considered it a function of the language of architecture. Not a utilitarian, not an efficiency function.
Not a decorating function.
And not a decorating function.
Right.
But mainly to go to the top of the building and put cosmos in it.
So you could almost say in your house, if you're looking at your eaves, or you're looking at the top of cabinets, or you're looking at stairs, the things that are datums don't have to be functional or decorative. They can actually be ornament.
They can.
That special thought.
They can be ornamented. Another thing about the word ornament is it's simultaneously a verb and a noun.
There you go. It is.
It on the one hand, it stands for a body of work that that Fosselone called the original language, the original visual language. You know, Stone Age ornament would have been taking a tool and putting niches and crosses on the surface of the tool. And there were basically two visual tropes that existed in the beginning of human civilization. One was ornament, which was a repetition of some sort of symmetry pattern.
Right.
And that was astral. It had to do with cosmos.
That's amazing.
And the other was pictographic.
Representational. Freezing of time.
People, animals.
So one actually takes advantage of time and movement, and the other one stops it.
Stops it, yeah. And makes it
this has been the best 15 minutes I've had in a few years. Kent Bloomer, you're the best.
You are, duo.
Thank you so much. And we'll get you in studio sometime.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Well, that was Kent Bloomer, inimically Kent Bloomer, who not only made huge, vast connections, but also brought up the fact that technology is not scary. The technology is actually not a change. It's merely an extension. And I'm talking to Louis Makel here in studio on Homepage Radio. And I can tell you pretty simply that, Louis, technology has changed your career.
Yes. It used to be when you wanted to make a line, you had two choices, either a straight line or a curved line of some sort, and the expense of doing the curved line in architecture was usually prohibitive. But because in the shop we have computer-driven equipment, couple of CNC machines, i.e. routers that are driven by software, we can make a funny geometry, I like to call it, pretty easily. I do want to reference a point that Kent was making about ornament. On buildings, one of the things that a building can do for people is to get them to look up.
Hmm.
And physiologically, when you look up, you become happier. And that's a nice thing.
You know, I think it's incontrovertibly nice. And our next segment's going to be with Barry Spiegels, an architect for lo these same 40 years or so, also Yale-based. And he has done some incredible design that I think, Louis, has really helped us look up. So we're going to take a quick music break here at WPKN 89.5 on your dial. And Rod Richardson, our engineer. WPKN is an incredible place, and I hope you'll listen to it all the time and give it lots of money, because without it, the station doesn't exist. We're going to take a quick music break and get Barry Spiegels on the phone, who is, I think, on the left coast, and we will have a three-way discussion about all the things we've been talking about. Welcome back to Homepage Radio, WPKN. I am Duo Dickinson, and I'm in studio right now with Louis Makel, who's an architect and a woodworker and a very interesting human. Hi, Louis.
Hi there.
And on the phone, I think from the former nation of Tanganyika, where are you, Barry?
San Francisco.
Oh, that's right, San Francisco, which I think is a province of the United States. Barry Spiegels is joining us. He's been an architect for at least 30,000 years and is based in New Haven. And Spiegels and Partners, their architect, has done some of the most amazing buildings around. The Christopher Columbus School, you might remember, and the new College Street condominiums that are there, Church and College. I forgot the name of the place, but with incredible botanic enrichments in it. But also his most famous commission, which I think everybody in maybe the world knows about, is he was the architect that replaced the Newtown Middle School that was so sadly compromised by a tragic human event. And he has enabled, through his unique skill sets as both an architect but also as a artist, to effectively make a place of hope and positive presence amid a very sad legacy. So welcome to Homepage, Barry Spiegels. I'd love to sort of bring you into the discussion that Louis and I have been having now for a half an hour, which essentially is, tell me about how the non-straight line architect persona that's so evidenced by all the architects we all know. Tell us how the non-architect part of your world has helped you be who you are, an architect.
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge the my good friend Louis, who's there, and Kent, whom you had on, as extraordinary inspirations for me. Kent, first of all, in school, and Louis shortly thereafter, when I was just beginning thinking I wanted to do something that was handmade, some sort of handmade house. And I met Louis, and he was at the time doing a home where he was casting the hinges for the windows. This was taking it down to an extraordinary level of detail that just completely blew my mind. But one thing that I think that all of us share is something that was Robert Irwin's wish too, which was to have people simply see the world as more beautiful than they did the day before. And Louis, something you said earlier, which is just to remind ourselves that we're alive, that is no small task in a world where we're traumatized all the time. And you mentioned the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Our charge there really was to make a school where the kids would feel happy to be there, happy to learn. And that was the most important direction I think that we could take. But going back to your question, which is how do other things inform the making of architecture? You want to phrase that again?
Well, I was just thinking in terms of, I think of you as this interesting architect human who not only does great buildings, but there is always the ineffable reality that you are an artist, and it's part of every building you do. And it's spontaneous, and it's also contextual. And I sense that you've got this wonderful dynamism within you that not only thinks about bricks and mortar and budgets and steel and glass, but also thinks about the things that give you joy and happiness, which is art to me.
Well, there it is. I think if we do what we enjoy doing, and have fun doing it, it comes out in the work that we do. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Louis? I mean, that's...
Absolutely. That's, if you don't enjoy it and don't have fun doing it, you shouldn't do it. Pure and simple.
Yeah, well, there we go. But the world, as we know, I mean, there you mentioned earlier about you didn't want to be commuting to New York in a suit as your life, and you wanted to have fun doing the things that you're doing. Well, how we are, literally how we are, is what our world becomes and things that we make. It comes out of how we are. And if we're having a good time, if we're connected to the things that we love, if we are literally enjoying it, bringing joy to it, it shows up in the world, in the work, inevitably. It's lawful.
In one of the weird things that just sort of sparked a conversation like this was over 25 years ago, a Japanese firm interviewed about 20 architects, and for some reason they hired me, and I'm not that famous or didn't think I was in league with the people they were interviewing, and I got the job, and I asked them for these three houses. I said, why would you ever hire me to do anything? They said, well, you've written books. And I said, yes, but other people have too. And he goes, no, well, yes. Well, we think your buildings are happy.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. It's a simple thing that connects to people. You were talking about earlier, and the show has to do with people in their own homes being enlivened by the circumstances. Being engaged in your environment is in itself a creative act.
Yes.
I just want to say that all of us are creative, and that we participated in different ways. And Louis, what you were saying earlier about the ping pong is a really important part of it. I think there is a public conception that the artist or the architect goes off and does his thing in a magic box and then comes back, and you're not supposed to look behind the curtain.
I think that is
incorrect, but doesn't get you where you want to go.
Yeah, no, it's
you need to be engaged with the people with whom and for whom spaces are being created. And if they're not, the spaces look like a good deal of the environment we have out there, which is disconnected. And that comes back to, again, what Louis was saying about, ourselves, reminding ourselves that we're alive in this creative engagement. It is fundamentally enlivening. We're related to the world in a more profound way that is extraordinarily important in a world today which is so bereft of that.
Yeah. I sometimes think when I'm drawing a building or a part of a building, I'm drawing my own arm. This is a part of my body. Is my elbow happy? Is the little thing at the end of my finger, the fingernail, is it smiling? How do I feel? How's my body feel? Because that's what a building is. My body, the door is my body.
Yeah.
The window is my soul.
Yeah.
Am I there? Is anybody there? Hello.
And you could take just that simple thing that I see in both of your work, and I hope in mine, is just the point that you made, Barry, that I think is exquisite, is that every human being is the same. Every human being is creative. Every human being feels joy. Every human deserves to feel joy and feel the kind of transportational lift that decoration in theory does, but never can fulfill the way I think your work does.
Well, decoration, ornament, and art. Kent, by the way, has been wonderful in giving a real language to what Louis and I do intuitively. It's important to remember, and this is really something that most people don't think about, that kind of engagement with one's environment that you were just talking about, Duo, has been going on for 40,000 years.
Yes.
40,000 years. Now, we've had this little blip, which is a nanosecond in that continuum of ornament being taken out, as you referenced Adolf Loos saying, ornament is a crime. that happened 80 years, 100 years ago.
Yep.
That's nothing. But because we're so temporally centric that we think that where we are right now is everything, we should remember that there's a reason why for 40,000 years art, ornament, decoration was in everything.
Yeah, it was part of the warp and woof of every day.
It couldn't not be. Yeah. The phrase
could not be.
The phrase thought police comes to mind. We're sometimes populated, our brains are populated with a thought police that is saying, "Oh, no, you can't do that."
Right.
As your hand took off on a little segue somewhere.
Well, what's interesting about this whole conversation, and both of you is, and Barry, I'll let you come in real quick, is that you're talking about some of the most elemental aspects of humanity, but also one of the hardest things to engender and have confidence in. Because I think if you look at a lot of religion, which tries to get down to the nitty-gritty of things, there's always, as I mentioned before, the law, which is, you know, usually the, you know, things like commandments or elements of a religion. And then you also have something called, and it's not just this, but it's in every human belief system, grace, which is a sense of joy and forgiveness and unmerited positive regard. And these are the hardest things in the world for me to grab a hold of, like Louis had mentioned, the fact that you try your best and then you realize that there's a better way. And I think you find that too, right, Barry?
Well, the challenge is not to be distracted, whether it's by the thought police or whether it's by the slings and arrows of everyday life.
That's correct.
That literally take up the space that might receive what you're referring to as grace or inspiration, any number of different words you might use, but things that connect ourselves to ourselves. We're separated and fragmented in the lives that we live, and it's largely because there isn't a place within us that can receive this joyful experience of being alive. And what? Once we touch that, it begins to open up the worlds of appreciation that is so rich and resonant. We're talking about what Kent does and what Louis, you do, and what you do, Duo. It is fundamentally about resonance, that we either recognize ourselves in it or we recognize some essential truth about how we live in life that begins to help us literally remember ourselves.
I have a little story that always comes to mind. If you take a human being and squish it flat, It is about the size of a 2.6 by 6.8 door. You squish a chicken and it's a lot smaller, or a horse, it's a lot bigger. So when you're looking at the door,
yeah,
you're looking at yourself, buddy.
That's pretty great. You know, and I think about all of this stuff, and I'm thinking that essentially you'd mentioned the inhibition or the desire to contour that you'd mentioned, Barry, the fact that you want to get back to the fact that we are somewhat shackled and limited by our own preconceptions. I mean, I do sense that at the deepest level, a lot of the problem with creating beauty is the fact that fear is everywhere and is a great limiting factor to releasing yourself to experiencing what I know you guys do every day. You want to find flaws because it's easier to find something that's scary than to find something that makes you feel good.
Well, in the face of that is another F word.
Yes. Absolutely. Which we can't use on this station.
I love it.
That's what I meant to say.
Yeah. Really.
That is the thing that we all relate to in terms of why we do what we do, frankly. Yes, it is to enjoy. We can put big words around it, but Jesus, it's fun. And when we engage our clients in the right level, all the way around, it should be fun. And that fun allows people, first of all, it relaxes people on a certain sense. You were talking about, Louis, people looking up. And I really believe that. That's when people do look up, something changes in them. When people laugh, something changes in them.
Yeah.
When people smile.
When people sing.
When people think, maybe.
Oh, I think he's sing, actually. Sing. I think when people sing, they just something changes.
Absolutely. Because there's that vibration inside. But the enjoyment, this goes back to something that I think all of us feel deeply about, and Louis, you were talking about in terms of the pencil and whatnot, and these conversations that you and I have around your that ridiculous little fire thing that heating iron. So, look, that's a really great little thing you have there in your studio. Having this conversation about drawing, and we keep coming back to enjoyment, which has to be something that we need to remember more and more, the enjoyment of drawing and the physical connection to it,
yeah,
the expression of it coming into, and how you are, again, how you are when you're doing that, is what it becomes. It comes out that way, and if we're frustrated, it comes out frustrated.
And furthermore, coming back to the time when you're totally lost, not infrequently, the line that comes out of the pencil that's scribbling on the plan, which you can't figure out, suddenly finds the way. It's as though the fingers, without your paying attention, have solved the problem. And you look down, you realize, oh, yeah, I could do that. No, that's a good idea. And then you realize, well, I did draw that, but your mind was someplace else.
Right.
That's an extremely important thing that you're saying.
And the scribble...
Right. Go ahead.
The scribble, which you thought meant nothing and was you were just killing time, all of a sudden the scribble is the answer. And I think, again, it comes down to the fact that the thought police, or the guy that's saying, well, you should be this way, and
then, right,
took a lunch break or something.
Got exhausted.
And got tired or passed out, whatever. And some lines came out that you realize, oh, and it's the unconscious has figured these things out before the conscious has. And it's so interesting.
And to remember that the thought police are not external to us.
Right.
Oh,
what is very often thought of as the thought police, who are telling us what to do, and yes, there's an aspect of that, but we've subscribed to it.
No, it's the internal thought police are are 10 times, 1,000 times the external thought police.
We have seen the enemy, and they are us.
They live inside.
Exactly right.
They're right there. I think this is an incredible conversation that could probably go on for another hour, But I know that in Somalia or Tanganyika, where Barry is, they're going to soon have a ritual involving setting animals on fire or something. So I just want to thank you, Barry, for the time you've taken to be with us. And just to let people know that if you like this interesting talk, Barry and I will be giving a talk at the Connecticut AIA headquarters on James Street in New Haven on June 20th. So put that down in your...
It'll be a conversation.
It'll be a conversation with everybody. It'll be a happening. It'll be an experience. Thank you, Barry. Thank you very much.
Very welcome. Great to be with you guys. I can't tell you.
Good to see you.
Likewise.
So if you liked what you heard and you had a thought about it, give a quick call at 203-336-9756. Call that number and we can get you in. But I just wanted to say, Louis, that in all of these conversations with these great people, there is this universality of appeal that human beings have with design and also joy, which has this natural manifestation not only in the creative line, but in the line jumping off the page and becoming something that you, Louis, and other people just literally make yourselves.
Yeah, well, it used to be, before Amazon, before Sears, before the store, everybody made whatever it was they had.
Yeah.
And that was it. And if you didn't make it, the guy next door made it. And that was true up until pretty darn recently.
Now, do you find it frustrating when you're talking to clients that what we're talking about here, the natural inhibition, the fear factor, the enemy, do you find that they gravitate you because they sense you aren't limited by that? Or do you find yourself almost like the aesthetic psychotherapist that actually gets people out of their sense of the law and limitation?
Well, if I am really doing my job, yeah, I help them make what they want. but uncovering what they want is not simple,
no,
as we all know, because we're not really used to doing that. We're used to buying what's on the shelf.
Yes.
Whether it's the idea or the window or the house.
I find actually that the most depressing thing, and you'd mentioned the fact that you have, Kent mentioned that he had no fear of technology, and you'd mentioned that I watched in 1987 as you took technology in the form of a computer, and you began to sort of reinvent everything you did in that new, larger set of hands. But I really do believe that Houzz, with several million hits now a day, that Houzz, this clipping service, has taken the creative and turned it into a dating service. The fact that you can actually see something you like and swipe one way or another and create a portfolio. And now, as an architect, we get sheaves and sheaves of images that are totally prefabricated and are as shallow as any human being can think of.
Yeah, no, I resist all of that because, again, I'm curious about what's in my little brain or what's in my client's brain as against what somebody clipped out of a magazine.
Yeah.
Very simple. But I'm not, but whatever gets you going, that's okay. If the magazine does it, just don't stop with the magazine.
Right.
That's all.
Be open to the things that are much larger than you. And also, I think, just to get a little cosmic at the end of this show, is I do think that almost everybody would admit that the last year has been a time of forced circumspection. The fact that things have changed dramatically in terms of the heroes we've put up in front of us or the villains we've put up in front of us, I think that a lot of people tend to be reacting more in fear than in hope. I don't know about you. What do you think?
Yes, but then I bet the WPKN listening audience has grown exponentially in the last few months because we all need help.
Louis, it has been an incredible delight to have you in the studio. Homepage has been graced by your presence and by the presence of Kent Bloomer and of Barry Spiegels. These are some of the greatest purveyors of art and architecture in the world today, and to have them all in one space for 55 minutes and perhaps the most wonderful assemblage of free will gifting radio that there is, WPKN 89.5 FM.
Amen.
Is truly one of the great acts of human faith. And with that, Rod, what a great show.
Present. All right. WPKN Bridgeport.
Hi, this is Steve DiCostanzo, GM of nonprofit community radio station WPKN 89.5 FM. Now more than ever, community radio is playing a bigger role in the lives of our cities and our communities. Unfortunately, the heart of our community radio station, our transmitter, is old and ailing, and the time has come. We have to replace it. The good news is we've already raised two-thirds of the $75,000 needed. To raise the final $25,000, we have set up a crowdfunding effort through Indiegogo's nonprofit arm called Generosity. With the help of local artist Liz Squalachi, we have thank you gifts of new coffee mugs, t-shirts, and a limited edition of 25 signed and numbered screen prints, all bearing the new design image for our transmitter crowdfunding effort. We call it My Transmitter, My Radio, My Community. How can you help? Obviously, financial contributions will get us to our needed goal, but all of you can help spread the word via social media and your own networks that WPKN needs a new transmitter to help sustain our broadcasting. All the details can be found at our WPKN.org website. From there, you'll find Generosity by Indiegogo, and we hope you will be generous with us when you do.
Hi, maybe you drive a car made in Japan or eat in a Thai restaurant or wear clothes made in Indonesia or possibly have digital devices from China. Well, Asia has become so very important in our lives that you may want to listen to the Soundprint Asia radio program with your host, Joseph Celli. Soundprint Asia on the 2nd and 4th Mondays at 10:30 a.m. or the 2nd and 4th Thursday afternoons at 2:30 on WPKN. I play an eclectic range of Asian music from over 30 countries, ranging from quiet meditative to ecstatic dervish music. So tune in for Soundprint Asia.
Make the Road Connecticut is an organization based in Bridgeport. It has built a thriving organizing hub that works with a growing membership base of parents, workers, and youth. Working together to improve schools, secure stable jobs for all, and making sure that immigrants are treated with respect and dignity. Now, more than ever, our community needs to come together against hate, racism, and xenophobia.
Call us at 203-549-8841. Again, that's 203-549-8841, or email us at julio.lopez@maketheroadct.org. And thank you to WPKN, listener-supported radio.
I'm Marie Dallas with the International Institute of Connecticut. It's a great organization that helps immigrants and refugees. Some of our clients have had to flee their homelands. We help them settle into new neighborhoods. Some are victims of torture, human trafficking, or violent crimes. We help these people build new lives. Some clients want to be reunited with family members. The International Institute of Connecticut has an array of programs and services to help all these new Americans. You can visit our website, www.iiconn.org, to learn more and to see how you can help. www.iiconn.org.
May Day General Strike, Solidarity and Resistance. On May 1st, immigrants, refugees, workers, women, students, people of faith, members of the LGBTQ community, and others who are resisting the new administration's attacks on all of us will rally and march. Speakers and entertainment on the New Haven Green from noon to 5 p.m., followed by a march to Fairhaven and a rally to protect all of our rights. More information is at General Strike, Solidarity and Resistance on Facebook.
Primero de mayo, huelga general, solidaridad y resistencia. Este primero de mayo, inmigrantes, refugiados, trabajadores, mujeres, estudiantes, gente de fe, miembros de la comunidad LGBTQ y otros en resistencia en contra de los ataques de esta administración, vamos a reunirnos y marchar. Oradores y presentaciones artísticas en el New Haven Green desde el mediodía hasta las 5 de la tarde, seguido por una marcha hasta el barrio de Fairhaven y una manifestación a favor de la protección de todos nuestros derechos. Más información en Huelga General, Solidaridad y Resistencia en Facebook.
You're listening to WPKN Bridgeport 89.5 FM and online at WPKN.org.